This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. 100 years ago this week, a huge earthquake rocked San Francisco, and the repercussions are still being felt today. Seismologists just released a new shake map. That's a map showing how the earth moved in Northern California in the early morning of April 18, 1906. A new book documents the damage done to San Francisco's buildings by the earthquake and reaches a surprising conclusion that architects and engineers were designing and building structures to be earthquake-resistant even before the turn of the 20th century. This hour, we're going to look back at the 1906 earthquake and look ahead to how the Bay Area would fare if the big one happened today. We're broadcasting from the Exploratorium in San Francisco, which sits precariously, seismically speaking, on landfill made from the rubble of the 1906 quake and near the site of extreme damage from the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake. Seismologists are forecasting another big quake in Northern California sometime in the next 25 years. And should that come true, what kind of destruction could follow? We'll talk about it with a structural engineer. Also, what is the region doing to prepare for this worst-case scenario? We'll hear about the state of California's emergency response plan, which is designed to kick into action within seconds of a major trembler. So if you'd like to join our discussion, give us a call. Our number, 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And if you're here in the audience here at the Exploratorium in San Francisco, you can step up to the microphone and tell us what's on your mind. Hopefully it's in the form of a question. And if you want more information, we'll be talking about that we're talking about this hour, you can go to our website at sciencefriday.com, where you'll find links to all of our topics. Let me introduce my guests. Mary Lou Zoback is a seismologist and the regional coordinator for the Northern California Earthquake Hazards Program at the U.S. Geological Survey in Menlo Park, California. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Zoback.
Thank you.
Good to have you back here. Charles Kircher is a structural engineer and a principal at Charles Kircher & Associates in Palo Alto, California. Welcome back to you, Dr. Kircher.
Good morning, Ira.
Rich Eisner is the regional administrator for the coastal region in the Governor's Office of Emergency Services in Oakland. Welcome back to the program, Mr. Eisner.
Good morning.
Good morning. And Stephen Tobriner is the author of Bracing for Disaster, Earthquake-Resistant Architecture and Engineering in San Francisco, 1838-1933, just out from Berkeley, the Bancroft Library and the Heyday Press. He's also a professor of architectural history at the University of California at Berkeley. Welcome to the program, Dr. Tobriner.
Thank you, Ira.
Dr. Zoback, let me start with you. And I mentioned that we're sitting on precarious ground, correct?
Absolutely.
Where did this rubble come from, left over from 1906?
Well, actually, this part of San Francisco was a bay. It used to be a little bay, small bay off San Francisco Bay. And beginning in the 1860s, they started pushing the sand dunes into the bay. So they'd already started reclaiming this land. Excuse me. But then after the earthquake, a lot more debris as well as more sand was pushed into the area.
You and your colleagues recreated the ground motion, right? Yeah. A simulation from the 1906 quake. Can you describe for us what actually happened in that quake from what you can determine?
Okay, what we did was we actually built a three-dimensional model of the Earth's crust in all of Northern California, and we put faults in it, and we put slip on the faults, and specifically the slip we believe occurred in 1906. The earthquake originated offshore from San Francisco, just a little bit around the bend here, about 2 miles offshore. It ruptured the San Andreas Fault, the entire length of the northern San Andreas, from San Juan Bautista in the south to Cape Mendocino in the north, roughly 300 miles. So the earthquake began somewhere near the middle and ruptured in two directions. It took about 90 seconds for the earthquake to actually break along the fault its entire length. But within 30 seconds, the really strong shaking had already spread out throughout the entire Bay Area where most people lived.
Mm-hmm. Hey, was it a complex break? Was it a simple one? Can you describe?
We now know from several lines of evidence, and some of it was the surveying data from the time, and also what the geologists observed at the surface, that it was a very complex break. It wasn't a uniform slip. Some parts of the fault slipped only 5 feet. Mm-hmm. And when I say slip, what I'm talking about is the fault movement, and the two blocks moved horizontally past one another. In other places, the slip was as high as 30 feet. And in fact, we know north of San Francisco, near Point Reyes, the slip was about 30, 32 feet. And that is an area where we see some of the greatest damage. The city of Santa Rosa is sitting on a plain. It's underlain by soft material. But also, the fault there slipped a lot. And the town of Santa Rosa, which is 20 miles from the fault, suffered some of the greatest damage per square area of anywhere along the quake.
Is it true that the despite the incredible damage in the fire created here in San Francisco, that it could have been worse?
Oh, absolutely, and that's what our modeling is showing us now. This was a best-case scenario for this earthquake.
This was the best-case scenario.
Best-case scenario, at least for where the population resides. Because the earthquake began offshore from San Francisco and ruptured away from the Bay Area in both directions, there's energy focused in the direction of rupture. So that energy was focused out of the built-up area. We've now been able to run simulations starting the earthquake in other places. And if we begin in the north, you just plow all that energy into the Bay Area, and the shaking will be much more intense and really affect the urban area.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Stephen Tobriner, in your book about the quake, you include some eyewitness accounts. Could you read for us one of those? It was one very really dramatic one.
Sure, Ira. This is an account of DeWitt Lippe, who was living on 3rd and Market Street. Those San Franciscans in the audience will know this is close to Moscone Center. He's living in a rooming house, a brick building, 5 stories high. He's on the 5th story, and he says this as he's looking west. As I looked out on this vista, everything was swaying. And first among these swaying structures to attract my particular attention was a tall steel smokestack over the Call power plant, which toppled down within the first few seconds. Almost immediately after these incidents, the great chimney of the San Francisco Gas and Electric Company's power plant, which had been swaying like a whip, broke off about at the middle, and the top went crashing down on the powerhouse itself, which caused a terrific explosion as the debris smashed the steam pipes and boilers beneath. About this time, the plastering in my room began to fall in, and the earthquake seemed to be pumping up and down. The place was shaking and showering plaster. I saw the swaying steeple of St. Patrick's Church give way and fall down en masse toward Mission Street. I then heard a tremendous noise. Thinking it was the Call building, I looked to my right toward Market Street, but the structure was still standing and apparently uninjured.
Wow. So how much of the damage to the city was caused by the rolling of the earth itself, and how much by the fires that have...
Well, there's been a lot of talk recently about the city's intentional dismissal of earthquake damage, but in fact, the earthquake damage accounted for 10 to 15%. 10 really is the number. 10% of the total damage to the city. The fire did 90% of the damage to the city.
Mm-hmm. And so there are lots of structures still left from that?
Absolutely. Yeah. If you look at the photographs, you have to remember that the photographers ran out. It took them a couple of hours to really start taking pictures. But when they did, they were taking pictures of catastrophe, and that is for them the most dramatic pictures. So you have dramatic pictures of some collapses and lots of pictures of fire. As you look at their fire pictures, you see in the foreground many buildings, thousands of buildings that have not collapsed. And if they haven't collapsed, we presume that the people inside were generally safe. Of course, there are internal problems. Chimneys could have fallen and mm-hmm. so forth.
Well, why did they not collapse? Were they built not to collapse?
Well, what is so fascinating is that 40 years before the earthquake of 1906, after the many earthquakes of the 1860s, starting in 1865 and 1868, we had 2 very bad earthquakes, engineers and architects, inventors and citizens themselves became very aware of earthquake danger and actually decided to build buildings that would be earthquake resistant. They realized that wood buildings were earthquake resistant. They were cheap, but they figured they were earthquake resistant as well, and even the rich folks built their buildings of wood because of that. And then in brick buildings, they developed all kinds of ways of tying these buildings together, and many of the successes in the earthquake of 1906 were due to this
this reinforcement that they put in them. And last, the steel frame buildings, which came to this city in the 1880s. We know that the first building put up, the old Chronicle building, put up by Burnham and Root, the famous Chicago team, was built to be earthquake resistant. They said it. They actually wrote it. This building is built not like Eastern buildings, but built to be earthquake resistant. They did their very best, and some of their techniques were terrific. Of course, they're not, they're not the same techniques that we'd use today.
Mm-hmm. Some of the major buildings that survived were what that we'd still see around
Well,
today?
The Call Building, which has been transformed in the Central Tower, on Market Street, is a survivor. And it's a survivor because it was designed to be earthquake resistant. It had various elements in it to make it that way. The steel frame was made to be very stiff and yet flexible, that is ductile, so it could move in the earthquake. But it had all kinds of braces, special portal braces, special X braces, and so forth, to make it resistant to earthquakes. Same with the Chronicle Building. It had lots of braces in the attempt to keep it from swaying too much in one direction or the other. And these are survivors, along with many other survivors. Perhaps the most famous brick building masonry building that's granite and sandstone is our old San Francisco Mint. And we think of that as an unreinforced masonry building, URM. However, if we look at the plans for the building, the architect, Alfred Mullett, tried to design it to be earthquake resistant. He designed a concrete foundation that he believed would move as a unit in the earthquake, and then in the building itself he put vertical and horizontal pieces of iron. Same with the Palace Hotel. So many of the famous buildings that you look at in these pictures that have survived, and where volunteers stayed in the buildings, in the federal buildings like the post office and Court of Appeals or the Mint, the federal employees did not evacuate when they were told to, and they saved these buildings from fire. But they could, because the buildings had been designed to be earthquake resistant even before 1906.
All right, we're going to take a short break and come back and talk lots more with our guests about the earthquake of 06 and possible earthquakes to come, how building design has changed since then. So stay with us. We'll be right back from San Francisco. I'm Ira Flato. This is Talk of the Nation, Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking about earthquakes, this 100th year anniversary of the 1906 earthquake in San Francisco. We're in San Francisco at the Exploratorium with Mary Lou Zoback, Charles Kircher, Rich Eisner, and Stephen Tobriner. Charles, you're a structural engineer.
Yeah.
How would we build the buildings differently? And was it amazing that these survived and are still standing to you as a structural engineer?
Yes, I think it's a testament that we had good engineering back then. I think we've got better engineering now.
How do you make a building resistant when you design a building here in San Francisco?
It has to be able to flex and absorb post-elastic response in a ductile manner so that it can bend without breaking.
Do you have to say, I can't build it on this spot because it's just a bad spot to build a building? What makes one, we were talking about with Dr. Zoback, where a bad area to build a building is? What is a really bad area, and what would be a better area? And do you actually say, don't build one here because it's too dangerous?
No, I don't think we say that. If it has a problem with the material below, it requires a special foundation, but it doesn't mean we can't build them.
Mm-hmm. And what is the best place and the worst place to build it?
Well, proximity to fault is a big issue. The closer you are, the stronger the shaking.
Mm-hmm.
Softer the soil, the stronger the shaking. So these are all things that engineers take into account when they design the building. We design it with more force when we're in areas closer to the fault.
Mm-hmm. Rich Eisner, we talk about I mentioned before, if and when the big one comes again, tell us about California's disaster plan and how it would kick in and what would trigger it.
Well, first of all, it's not if. We know we live in an earthquake-active area. We are going to have many quakes in the Bay Area. In fact, we have a lot of quakes every day. They're just not felt. So when a disaster, and it's not just an earthquake, occurs, the state system is that local governments are in charge, local governments are first responders, and the entire state mobilizes to support those cities and counties in their response. We provide resources, we provide expertise, technical assistance, personnel.
But what's going to happen? What would go on, you know, should an earthquake occur?
Well, when the earthquake occurs, we will open our operation centers both in the Bay Area and in Sacramento. We will start drawing down, identifying resources, National Guard troops, specialized personnel, medical services personnel that need to be brought in to assist the local governments. The biggest challenge to any disaster, literally any disaster in the Bay Area, is the bridges and the bay itself. The bay is here because of earthquake activity. The beauty of the Bay Area is driven from earthquake activity. The challenge is it creates some challenges for us in response. Mm-hmm. The Bay Bridge, as it's currently standing out there, is not earthquake resistant. We know that we're rebuilding the eastern portion of it. If the earthquake occurs before that bridge is completely rebuilt and the BART tube is strengthened, we'll have some real problems in getting around the bay and providing mutual aid to the jurisdictions here.
Mm-hmm. Is this something that's on everybody's mind every day when you live in
It's certainly on my mind, but it goes with the job. I think people are aware of it, but I think there's people focus on what the attributes of the Bay Area are, the beauty, the climate, the cultural attractions.
The trade-off.
And they do trade off the threat.
Right, right. Let's talk, Charles, a bit more about the earthquake. You've taken earthquake scenarios done by the seismologists and used to predict the likely damage. Tell us a bit about that, what kind of damage we're talking about, what you could predict would occur.
All right. We built a model that is a collection of many different theories that model the response of buildings and other structures, and then subjected all those elements of the model to the scenario shaking you've described. The model covers 19 counties in the greater Northern California area, including approximately 10 million people and about $1 trillion worth of buildings. Half of those people and half the buildings are within 25 miles of the San Andreas Fault. What we found is that of this population of people and buildings, approximately 120,000 residences will be significantly damaged. Approximately 10,000 commercial buildings will be significantly damaged. As many as 250,000 households will be displaced. That's folks that will need temporary shelter somewhere. Mm-hmm. Somewhere between 1,800 nighttime casualties and 3,400 daytime casualties, and a total building damage price tag of about $120 billion, excluding fire following, which will occur, and excluding damage to lifelines. Mm-hmm. If you throw those in, the total cost we estimate to be around $150 billion.
Wow, in damage.
In damage.
Rich Eisner, is the city able, the region able to get its arms around this and be ready for it?
It's not just the city or the region or the state. An event like this would impact the world economy and would be devastating to the national economy.
Did you learn anything from something like Katrina and how to handle an earthquake from a flood, or is it a different plague that you're talking about?
Well, they're very different events in how they affect people and how the events affect structures. We're still learning from Katrina. I mean, the lessons are about reconstruction and recovery are still being learned and documented. We need to learn a lot more about how these events that disrupt economies, disrupt communities, can be responded to effectively. We can't just relocate the population. That's what they found out in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. You can't have business if you don't have employees. You can't have business or employees if you don't have housing. Right. All these things are interrelated.
Mm-hmm. Mary Lou Zoback, you've said that the 06 earthquake marked the beginning of earthquake science.
That's right. This was the first time that we recognized the San Andreas Fault, not just, you know, a portion of it, but they actually mapped the entire fault. The 200 miles on shore that broke in Northern California, some poor guy had to get on a horse, take the maps that were available, and follow it to Southern California. So we found out it extended the length of the state. In addition, the geologists were able to tell that this wasn't just a random event. This had been part of a recurring process. There were very small-scale features that they could detect along the fault zone. And they even came up with the notion that it was probably every few hundred years. And in addition, in Southern California, we'd had a large earthquake in 1857. Few people lived there then, but they could show that occurred on the same fault. So we really recognized that this was some kind of process impacting California. And furthermore, they used the surveying data, and they resurveyed after the earthquake, and they could tell that some sort of horizontal forces were acting far from the fault, and that was actually loading the fault. And this led to probably the biggest scientific discovery from the earthquake, and that was the recognition of what today we call an earthquake cycle, that you have a period of loading distant from the fault that loads the fault, and you can think of the fault like a thick, or the Earth's crust like a thick elastic sheet. And as you shear the edges of that, you actually are putting energy into the sheet. And when the fault breaks, it's locked in between big earthquakes. When it breaks, it releases that energy in the form of seismic waves. And then, and they recognize this too, the cycle begins all over again.
Was this before the whole concept of plate tectonics was talked about?
It was amazing. This was 60 years before plate tectonics. Geologists at the time were familiar with faults that had vertical motion because gravity could drive vertical motion, or if you squeeze two blocks together, one would override the other. So they were very familiar with that. But they were completely baffled by what kind of horizontal forces, because if you think about it, you come into real problems on the ends of the fault. And their explanations were pretty ad hoc at the time.
So that really did help them figure this out.
Oh, well, it helped us in present time put this all in context.
Yeah, we still don't have a reliable way to predict an earthquake. I remember the Parkfield experiment many years ago. Mm-hmm. I spent many hours and years walking up and down and looking at the instruments in the ground and the laser ranging, and everybody was so, almost like clockwork, every 20 years an earthquake happened there and we're going to be ready for that.
Right.
Didn't happen.
Yeah, we were waiting to.
Mother Nature, really, was on time for all those times except this one.
If earthquakes were regular, obviously we'd be able to predict them. But unfortunately, an analogy I like to use is the meteorologists have been very successful tracking hurricanes.
Right.
And they do this because they have a really good three-dimensional model of the Earth's atmosphere. And they can sample that directly by flying through it. They can look at it with satellites. So they really know what's going on. So when we have a disturbance, a tropical storm, they can actually predict how it's going to evolve and whether it'll evolve into a large hurricane. We don't have that three-dimensional model of the Earth with the faults in it. But we are now, with new technologies, interestingly, seeing very intriguing signals down deep in the Earth's crust, beneath the level where earthquakes occur. And 10 years ago, we couldn't even detect these, but we're measuring them now. They don't always lead to an earthquake, but we're sure they're part of the process. So we may be zeroing in on the trigger, and we're working now on building this three-dimensional model. So I think sometime in the future, if earthquakes are predictable, and we still don't even know that, but if they are, I think we'll have those models.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else want to jump in?
I just add that Parkfield may not have been a successful prediction experiment, but it was the real genesis of our partnership, emergency management's partnership with the Earth Sciences. And since the mid-70s, we daily collaborate, we exchange information. If there's a moderate earthquake, we'll call them or they'll call us and tell us what their assessment is. Our whole public education and public communication revolved around Parkfield and how we tell the population about the threat and how we communicate if there was a prediction, a short-term prediction. So Parkfield, I think, was beneficial, just wasn't beneficial to the Earth Sciences.
Hmm. Well, good. No, we learned a lot, actually, from the experiment, but we learned that a lot of things didn't work.
Charles, did you want to say something?
Well, as a structural engineer, we go with Rich's prediction, which is not if it's going to happen. So we design for its occurrence. The real benefit, I think, it's been coming from the USGS is giving us an understanding of the probabilities of these, which we then can use in our evaluation of relative risk from one fault to another. Mm-hmm. So we design for the event.
Do you think, Mary Lou, that the rest of the country, which is susceptible for earthquakes, two earthquakes, certainly the Midwest, which has had the biggest one on record, is just biding its time and not building earthquake-resistant structures like they should? And I'll, Charles, what do you think also? I mean, Mary Lou first. They're going to have their own big one someday and not be ready for it?
Yeah, you know, it's a struggle for us. California is earthquake country, but earthquakes occur throughout most of the United States and the Pacific Northwest, they've had the biggest earthquake. And that was a magnitude 9 on January 26, 1700. We've now been able to backtrack. Right.
Yeah.
We can see the evidence. We can see the tsunami that swept over the shoreline there. And we actually know the precise date from tsunami records in Japan. So that was a huge earthquake. That will impact that entire region. But I think, as a seismologist, my worst nightmare is when we have a repeat of an earthquake in the central or eastern United States. The Earth's crust there is much colder than the active western part. That means it's a much more efficient transmitter of seismic energy. So the waves are going to travel harder, farther, and they're going to be stronger. Mm-hmm. So an equivalent size earthquake will have a much bigger impact. And as Charlie can tell you, they haven't built for those kinds of earthquakes back there. The schools are brick. The police stations, the fire stations are brick. It's going to be a huge catastrophe, but unfortunately, we know it'll happen. The areas that have had large earthquakes in Charleston, South Carolina, New Madrid, Missouri, on the Boot Hill of the state of Missouri, on the Mississippi River, offshore from Massachusetts. From what we know, these earthquakes recur on a time period of about 500 years. Mm-hmm. So we don't have that much historic record here.
Mm-hmm. Our number 1-800-989-8255. If you'd like to join us, please step up to the microphone here. We'll take some questions from our audience, if there are some. Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Let's go to the phone, see who would like to make a comment. Let's go to Ed in Kansas City, Kansas. Hi, Ed.
Hi, how are you all today?
Hi, how are you?
I found it interesting that you were just talking about the possibility of an earthquake in the central part of the United States. Of course, we sit on the same limestone ledge here that extends on across to the New Madrid Fault area. In 94, after the Northridge earthquake, I was allowed to go out and study fire system damage. And I found it interesting that in the context of the code changes that had been adopted after Loma Prieta, that fire protection systems, I'm a retired code official and fire protection official here in Kansas City, and it interested me that even in that interim where fire protection was taken into account in earthquake-resistant designs, that there was so much damage following the Northridge quake. And on the photographs that I brought back with me when I was showing them around and writing up the results of my studying the damage, everybody liked to make the comment of, isn't it interesting how the older buildings survived so much better than the newer designs? And after they had their duh moment and realized that in Los Angeles, that's how you get to be an older building, is not falling down in the first earthquake. It just interested me that even in the context of having made these improvements in the designs, that we still didn't have it quite right.
Let me get it.
Do these newer models help to hone in a little bit better?
Mm-hmm. Charles Kircher, any reaction?
Well, we always learn a lot after each earthquake. in terms of seismic code improvement, those of us who work on the code committees, we know that we always have a hot topic that comes up. In Northridge, it was steel moment frames that were supposed to be very resistant to earthquake damage, but no, they had cracks. And we found out about certain types of wood apartment houses with tuck-under garages that became killers.
Because there's no structure above the garage. The garage is hollow.
The garage is hollow. It's got a soft first story.
Yeah.
Soft first stories weren't exactly a surprise, but that configuration was new. So, yeah, the seismic codes improve after each earthquake because we learn about a new problem.
Mm-hmm. And so it's a constant learning experience from you just go see what broke and what didn't break.
It's the best laboratory, unfortunately.
Rich, yeah?
In response, fires continue.
A wealth of information.
What was that, Ed?
I was able to bring back to Kansas City a wealth of information on that wood construction. The building, the apartment building there in Northridge that where so many people were killed, I actually participated in recovering valuables from the people's apartments that had been crushed, and it gave me the opportunity to get in under the structure and really see how the damage had occurred, and it was very enlightening. we had just gone under seismic zone classification here in Kansas City with the adoption of the new Uniform Building Code in 92.
All right. Hang on, we have to take a break, and we'll come back and talk lots more about earthquake reconstruction and earthquake predictions. Take more calls and folks from the studio audience here on Science Friday. So stay with us. We'll be right back from San Francisco. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about earthquakes with my guest, Mary Lou Zoback, seismologist and regional coordinator for the North California Earthquake Hazards Program at U.S. Geological Survey in Menlo Park, California. Charles Kircher, structural engineer and principal at Charles Kircher & Associates in Palo Alto. Rich Eisner, regional administrator for the coastal region in the Governor's Office of Emergency Services in Oakland. And Stephen Tombriner, author of Bracing for Disaster, Earthquake-Resistant Architecture and Engineering in San Francisco, 1838 to 1933. He's also a professor of architectural history, UC Berkeley. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to some patient people in our exploratorium audience. Yes, sir.
Hi, Ira. I'm Robert Kobus, visiting San Francisco from Portland, Oregon. And Mary Lou Zoback made a comment about tsunamis. In the coastal regions of Oregon, we are worried about tsunamis. Doesn't the Bay Area worry about them too?
The Bay Area, all of coastal North America needs to worry about tsunamis. I think the difference, though, is that you have a local source of a tsunami, and it will be large, very close in, whereas in the Bay Area, we don't really anticipate a local source for tsunami, but we have been struck a number of times by distant ones from Alaska.
Mm-hmm. So, and why was there no tsunami in this 06 earthquake?
There actually was a very small tsunami, strictly speaking. We have a tide gauge at Fort Point, which is right underneath the Golden Gate Bridge, and it recorded the motion of the water down dropped 4 inches over a time period of 15 minutes, and then it recovered. And then later we can see some sloshing of energy that went into San Francisco Bay and came back out. But fundamentally, the faults in the Bay Area move largely horizontally, and when you get a tsunami, you need a vertical displacement of a large amount of water.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-989-8255. Let's stay here in the audience and take another question. Yes.
I'm a local. I live down in San Mateo County on the coast, a little bit farther south than San Francisco. And my question is, okay, so we prepare as much as we possibly can for earthquakes, but one of these days it's going to shake. Maybe, in fact, during this program, it's going to start shaking. What do we do? I've heard recently that what we've been told for years to get either under a door jamb or under a table is not the best course of action, and that you actually should get next to a piece of furniture because as things fall, it will form a void. So I wonder if your panel could actually comment on what is the proper thing to do.
Rich Eisner's head is shaking so fast.
I know, I saw that.
That I have to, before it falls off, I have to go to him.
It'll fall off shortly. I mean, we were all told by our parents to get in the doorway. And we learned, actually looking at occupant behavior and damage and injuries in earthquakes, that getting in a doorway doesn't really protect you. What you need to do is get down under a piece of furniture to protect you from falling debris. The issue of whether it's under or next to a table, if you're next to a table and a light fixture comes down, you have no protection whatsoever. So the message to our kids, to any person living in earthquake country or visiting, is get down, get under a sturdy piece of furniture. If there's no furniture, get as far away from the outside walls of your structure as you can to an interior area of your house.
Steve Tobriner, could you tell from pictures and your research of past quakes if that's true? I mean, did things, people who go under these things survive? And well, it's a good place to hide, or
we have some indication that people were aware that running out of a building, and particularly a brick building, was really dangerous. We have one person saying, "Don't go outside; it's an earthquake." At least he recalls saying this to his friends to stop them, and other people saying, "Oh my God, they're running out of the building. It's going to, the facade is going to fall down on them." So we do have some, definite proof. Right. Also, this business of brick cornices and things of that sort falling into the street in 1906. The reason that the fatalities were relatively small in relationship to the earthquake. About less than 1% of the 400,000 people that were here. It was because it was early in the morning and people were not out in the streets and were not hit by debris. Mm.
Rich, do you hear this question all the time from people who live around here? What do? You stay inside? You go outside?
Well, we've heard the question, and there's one particular person who's an advocate for this idea that you don't get under furniture. We try to just get people to look at pictures of damage and see where the hazardous places are. It's on the sidewalk. It is in front of buildings. It's at the facade.
Right.
We also have data, a lot of data from earthquakes, that the more you try to move, the more likely you're going to be injured. The strong motions are going to overtake you and knock you off your feet.
Oh, is that right? Yeah. Well, those of us who have never been in a major earthquake cannot imagine what that must feel like.
Well, come on back.
but Mary Lou says, if I sit in this spot long enough.
That's true.
Yes, right in the audience there.
Okay, so I have a question. Where's the safest place to keep your earthquake box that holds, like, your three-day food supply and stuff like that?
Earthquake box, new concept for those of us of hurricanes, but we can understand what that means. Yes.
Well, it's both a functional question and a structural question. You want to put your earthquake supplies, the water, portable radio, et cetera, in a place that's accessible where all the family members can find it, typically not in the basement, which is likely to be filled with debris, but just accessible. And the important thing is that you have a kit, you have a supply of water and food, a flashlight, a portable radio that you can get information from the media.
Okay. Do you have one?
No.
You don't have a kit yet. Are you going to get one?
Probably.
Yeah. Okay. Well, what should you have? Is an earthquake kit the same kind of thing you would have for a hurricane, or is it different?
Well, the basic issues are you're being displaced, so you need water, you need food, you need a way of getting information from the government or the public agency, so you need a portable radio with batteries, you need a flashlight. So if the earthquake occurs at night, mm-hmm. you should have sturdy shoes available so that you're not walking on debris. And we recommend that every family have a family or friend's number outside of the damaged area that they can mm-hmm. call and check in, because lack of information just drives people up the wall.
What did you learn about how populations behave from the 1989 quake, where cars were quite abundant, from, let's say, the 06 quake, where people maybe didn't have such kind of transportation? Did they try to get out of town in 06, Stephen?
Absolutely. Southern Pacific Railroad, that was a friend that wasn't a friend to everyone, being a huge monopoly, actually was able to give free passage to 300,000 people leaving the city who wished to leave. The poorest people, a lot of disabled people, remained in the city, and the city responded along with the federal government in a really incredible way by first putting up tents, and then we all in San Francisco know these earthquake shacks. About 5,000 small wooden buildings were put up at the city to shelter the people who didn't leave. My grandfather and great-grandfather did, in fact, leave, along with my father. They went to Oakland and then came back to rebuild.
Hmm. Wow. Well, what could the city do today? I'll ask all of you. What do you think that San Francisco and California could do to make the city a safer place? Mary Lou, any thoughts on this?
Well, I think we...
Are there places already that exist that could be sheltered, or what would happen?
I think we already know where the shaking is going to be the strongest. Some of our modeling has shown us that. And we also know from the studies that Charlie and Stephen and their colleagues have done that we have a real problem with urban housing, and particularly in the urban core of the Bay Area. A lot of very old structures, mm-hmm. this softer story architectural style that Charlie alluded to, where there's really not much support for shaking on the first floor, and above it, apartments. The numbers that Charlie gave, we're talking about 500,000 people homeless here in the Bay Area. And San Francisco is on a peninsula. Where are those people going to go? We have a few ferries. We don't have a lot of ferry capacity. So I think it's going to be a huge catastrophe on the scale of Katrina.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else want to?
Well, let's talk about what you might think of as bad buildings. We mentioned the soft story structures.
Right.
We still have a number of unreinforced masonry buildings that have not yet been retrofitted. And the engineers are increasingly concerned about what we call non-ductile concrete, which means it's going to behave in a brittle manner. What we found from the study was that about half of all those people that are estimated to be fatalities will die in those sort of buildings, even though those buildings represent less than 5% of all the building types, which means it's a relatively small quantity. It's something we can address. We're already addressing unreinforced masonry with programs to retrofit them. We need these sort of programs to remove more bad apples from the barrel.
Is this a money problem, then, to get to reinforce these things?
Not always. There's often some very cost-effective ways of making these buildings safe. But since it's a relatively small population of all buildings, it's something we can do.
Mm-hmm. Rich?
I think we can wait and let the earthquake tell us what the bad buildings are, which will cost lives and just disrupt our communities. Or we can strengthen those buildings. And really, strengthening the buildings, which will take decades, we know that this is a long-term process, will change the outcome of the earthquake.
We always think about in disasters, about the first responders. And hospitals are certainly going to be among the first responders. Are they among the most vulnerable places, or are they pretty well safe?
I'll let Charlie speak to that.
We have...
Are you passing the buck from the state to the... Okay.
And
the,
to a structural engineer.
And the structural engineer will start this and pass the buck back. But there is Senate Bill 1953, which is addressing specifically the safety and functionality of hospitals, and as a result of that bill, hospitals are undergoing first a survey process and then an improvement process. And the survey has come back with some incredibly pessimistic views of hospital performance, and that is what Rich is alluding to. On the peninsula of approximately 100 medical facilities, both hospitals and clinics, only 7 were considered to be up to snuff with the most current standards for functionality.
Wow.
And over half are considered to be some sort of life safety risk. Engineers like myself, we don't necessarily believe this to be anything but overly pessimistic, but then folks like Rich, who have to deal with how are we going to get folks taken care of in case they're injured, are facing these statistics right now.
Mm-hmm. It's hard to be optimistic in this business. I think we have the emergency management systems to respond, but if we have no place to take the victims, or if the bridges are damaged and we can't move victims, we're really constrained, and it's quite frustrating to get this kind of information. The best plans and the best organizations and the best systems can't solve a problem if you don't have the facilities.
We're talking about earthquakes this hour from San Francisco on Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. I hear what you're saying. I hear the concern. I'm going to get Stephen to react to this. What is your view of listening to the business and the political side of this?
Well, I have to say that the University of California at Berkeley has done an outstanding job of retrofitting its buildings. It's our taxpayers' dollars, but we've put in $500 million to make that campus earthquake resistant. This means resistant to the loss of life, the loss of our children and the staff there. The buildings have been upgraded in an amazing way. And remember that we had major earthquakes in Berkeley, but they didn't cause damage to the university. So this is mitigation before damage. And it's a terrific exemplar of what can be done.
Is this your way of saying, guys, spend the money in San Francisco, get it done?
Yes, I think it's really important that we live in a beautiful place, and we have to pay what I call the earthquake tax, both individually and actually as a state.
Mm. Rich, you want to touch that potato?
Well,
pretty hot now.
I agree with Steve, and I think that we do have to make these investments. The other part of, and I just want to sort of emphasize that this is not a San Francisco problem.
Okay.
Most of coastal California is in very high-risk seismic zones. The rest of the state is in a seismic zone. We're at the edge of the boundary, the plate boundaries. So the 1906 event was 19 counties, not just San Francisco. The next event could be 19 counties affecting 10 million people, the vast majority of whom will survive. But they'll be victims nonetheless if the economy is destroyed, if their life investments are gone.
Mm-hmm. I have time for one really quick question.
Really quick question for either Stephen or Charles. How do you retrofit something like the football stadium at Cal, where the fault goes through the center of it.
You make two football stadiums out of it. Seems pretty easy back east. That's what.
I'll start this, Steve. I went to Stanford, so I'll let Stephen answer the rest of it.
Well, it's a very difficult question, which we're struggling with right now, because we have a better football team. There's now interested donors to help us with this stadium, which was built across an active fault. And the engineers and architects, and I'm on a committee called the Seismic Review Committee, we're all struggling with trying to figure this out.
Did they know it was an active fault when they built it?
Well, they did, in fact. And we're quite... on the university, for example, we have these wonderful buildings like Sather Tower that our great campanile was designed in 1914, and Charles Derleth, the engineer who was there when the stadium was being planned, built that building to be earthquake resistant, and it's an incredible building, interesting in his prescient ideas about earthquake resistance in 1914, which was very early. But this stadium thing is like, wow, how could they possibly have done it? We have Lawson on the faculty, Derleth on the faculty, yet there it is. And it's a huge problem for us. There are several possibilities for the current solution, to basically break those stands of the university that go across the fault into two. Right. So that,
we're going to have to leave you figure this out on your own.
All right.
I mean, if you can mess it up building it, you'll have to fix it later on. I thank you all for taking time to be with us. Stephen Tobriner, author of A Bracing for Disaster, Earthquake-Resistant Architecture and Engineering in San Francisco, 1838 to 1933, also professor at UC Berkeley, figuring out what to do with that stadium. Rich Eisner, Regional Administrator for the Coastal Region in the Governor's Office of Emergency Services in Oakland. Thank you for being with us. Charles Kircher, structural engineer and a principal at Charles Kircher and Associates in Palo Alto. Thank you for being here. And Mary Lou Zoback, thanks for coming back. Dr. Zoback is seismologist and regional coordinator for the Northern California Earthquake Hazards Program at the U.S. Geological Survey in Menlo Park, California. Thank you all for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you. Thank you, Ira.
This program is produced by Annette Heist and senior producer Karen Berghoff. Our directors are Sarah Handel in Washington and Charles Berquist here in San Francisco. Our interns are Flora Lichtman and Andrea Thompson. Barry Hardiman and Odette Youssef worked the phones for us today. As I say every week, search forward to our website at sciencefriday.com. You can podcast Science Friday and blog it if you'd like. And also we have back editions of Science Friday to take along with you. Also, Kids Connection is there. We make free teaching curricula from Science Friday. We always know how much trouble teachers have teaching science in their classes, but we're out there to help them. So stay with us. Keep up the good fight for teaching science. I'm Ira Flatow in San Francisco.